Just a small word about that glorious passage from Isaiah. First of all, we need to clear some stuff up, because there's a common misconception that a prophet is supposed to be somebody who foretells the future. That's not the biblical understanding of prophecy. The Bible takes the Greek word prophetes literally, somebody who speaks for somebody else. And the prophets believed, although Jeremiah questioned this himself, whether he was cockamamie or a real prophet, that they believed that they saw God the way they saw the world, the way God sees the world. So what Isaiah is talking about is this vision that pervades the whole Bible of the kingdom of God. And what he does is cast it into form like Aesop, of talking about animals. So if all the animals of the earth who have these natural antagonisms are somehow reconciled with each other, the opposites come together, a fortiori, even more strongly, we human beings are supposed to come together too, despite antagonism, despite all the differences that we know in our lives. Okay, I would like to go further with the suggestions I made last Sunday about Advent. Advent is a celebration of emptiness. Emptiness. The absence of God from our lives, which, as I said last week, and after a week of reflection, it's even more true. I don't feel that emptiness. I don't feel that emptiness. Life rolls on regularly for me, you know, bills to pay, stuff to do, and that's the end of it. And it's interminable. But that's not the kingdom of God. We certainly cannot look around at the world we're living in right now and say, this is the kingdom of God. This is human beings reconciled to each other. Because if anything, it's quite the opposite. All you have to do is look around. You don't have to go to Mosul or Aleppo. Look at the United States. Look at us. You know? So I would suggest another metaphor besides the absence of God. There's a God-shaped hole in my life, H-O-L-E, that is, which again I don't experience, but I know that's what I'm called to as a would-be Christian. So what does a God-shaped hole look like? I'm not sure that we can supply one metaphor for another and get it any further, but I'd like to suggest tonight some content for that hole. So again, going back to the Gospel of Luke, to that article, which I find irrefragable. Lovely word I've never used before. You can't argue with what that guy was saying about the Christian life. And so when I read that, it becomes very clear to me, even clearer to me, that I have a God-shaped hole in my life, which I'm not even conscious of. So what does a God-shaped hole get filled in with? That's what I want to talk about. The answer is very simple. Other people. Other people. The God-shaped hole is filled with other people. Love your neighbor as yourself. The great commandment, the love of God and the love of neighbor. And then, of course, that great question that a lawyer asking, who's my neighbor? And the answer is clear from Jesus' own life. Everybody. And that's where the rub comes in, I think. Everybody is my neighbor. I'm quite happy to be with people who share my ideas, my tastes in music or art or literature or politics. I'm comfortable with that. But in doing that, I simultaneously exclude perhaps the majority of humankind. Francis, the first Francis in Assisi, had an interesting, leprosy in the Middle Ages was horrendous. All this unclean, people running around with a bell and shouting unclean so people wouldn't, because that's what they thought the contagion was. It turns out not to be, but that's all right. They didn't know. So you avoided lepers. So what did Francis do? Francis was a good medieval citizen. He avoided lepers too. But what did he do? He invited a leper into his community, washed his feet and legs, and drank the water he washed them in. I put it to you that what Francis was doing was simply acknowledging the humanity of another person. And that, of course, is the key notion here. Before we are brighter or richer or more beautiful or stronger than anybody else, we are equal to everybody else because we are co-humans. This will just break your head. I know in all the African tribes, every time they want to talk about people who belong to the tribe, they refer to them as members of the tribe. Anybody who's outside the tribe is not human. The Inuit word for person is human being. And therefore, if you're not Inuit, too bad for you. You've fallen off the train. You're not human. So the God-shaped hole is filled with what James Joyce, I think, said, here comes everybody. That was James Joyce, so-called atheist. No, he wasn't atheist. He was anti-Catholic in many ways, and rightly so, I believe. But he said the church should be described as here comes everybody. I don't do that. The church, unfortunately, in its symbolism, does not do that. We've lived, thanks to the Roman Empire, under a hierarchical system where some people are superior to others in their humanity. I vividly remember when I was driving people to the high school job in Rochester, New York, I picked up a newly minted Notre Dame BA, a Holy Cross brother, Thomas Jumenta. I will never forget this. So we drove all the way from South Bend to Rochester, New York, and Tom was sitting next to me. In the course of the conversation, I know I am superior to everybody because I am avowed religious. Can you think of anything more anti-Christian than that? Oh, Father, pray for me because I know God hears your prayers and doesn't give a damn about me. How many times I've heard that to my disgust. Again, going back to Francis, the second Francis, the famous one now. If you remember that extraordinary night where he came out in his white dress, no red and gold vestments for him, his little white dress and his little iron cross, not a gold one with a gold chain. First thing he said to all those thousands of people in Vatican Square, pray for me. I've never heard a bishop, much less a pope, say anything roughly comparable to that. So the question arises, was this a theatrical gesture on the part of Francis Bergoglio? I don't think so. I've read enough biographies of him to see the massive transformation he underwent in his own life from being an autocratic superior of the Jesuits in Argentina to spending an inordinate amounts of time walking to slums after taking public transport. And I think that's one of the main reasons why he is experiencing such antagonism in the Vatican. It's tom jumenta writ large. I know I'm superior. I'm a member of the Roman Curia. I'm a cardinal archbishop. I'm a bishop. I'm a priest, for God's sake. I don't think I've entertained the delusion that I was in any way superior to anybody else from the day I was ordained. And remember, to my shame, when the father of a guy I knew very well in the seminary, an Irishman, came after my first Mass, kissed my hands. I thought, God, help us. I should be kissing your feet, man. What are you doing? So far have we deluded ourselves, or been deluded, by the system, the hierarchical system of the church. I've come not to be served, but to serve. That's Jesus. So it might be useful, I'm going to do it tonight, to make an inventory of all the people I believe are subhuman, who fall beyond the pale of our common humanity. It's a useful exercise. Whom do I not recognize as a fellow human being? To that extent, the God-shaped whole remains the God-shaped whole, empty, with nobody there. And this is not the ravings of a demented old man. I'm old, but I'm not demented, according to my doctor. I think this is simply a deeper understanding after all these years of what the devil, the gospel, is all about. What the Christian life really costs. A wonderful thing you could read during Advent is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Does anybody know Dietrich Bonhoeffer in this room? He was a Lutheran pastor, had this cushy job at Union Theological. He was a German seminary in New York. The Nazis came to power. He went back to Germany. Founded an underground seminary for Lutheran pastors. Plotted an assassination attempt on Adolf Hitler, which was discovered. He was sent to jail and later stripped naked and hanged. He wrote a wonderful book called The Cost of Discipleship. And this was what I was trying to address last week. We have domesticated, we have conventionalized Christianity. We are respectable. You know, go through those little cemeteries. A good Christian woman, a good Christian man buried here. That elevated us to a level of respectability, where we were untouchable by anybody who was not a good Christian man, according to somebody's lights. But I don't think Jesus lights. So we're waiting. We're waiting in Advent for all these invisible people. So many whores, cheaters, mafiosi, the physically deformed. That was one of the great benefits of raising Andre, who, as you know, had polio on both his legs. Living with three black sons and a handicapped one was enormously eye-opening to me. We would go to downtown Lusaka. I would take him downtown. So here's this little black kid, very short, walking on crutches with leg braces. People regularly stopped and stared at him as if he were a two-headed cow. Well, that's Africa, isn't it? No, it's not. It happened exactly the same street on Richmond Street in London, Ontario. The same demeaning, depersonalizing response to a person who is not like me or like I should be. So the categories are numerous. They're racial, they're sexual, they're sexually orientated. You know, we still burn fags, either really or somewhat not really, by demonizing them, demonizing homosexual people. And again, that's one of the great advantages of being chaplain at King's. I listened to the stories of about a half dozen men and women who were homosexual, who, when they knew me well enough, would come and talk to me and open up. And I listened with constant heartbreak to the stuff that they experience in the university. You know, this great liberal outpost of all inclusivity. It's rubbish! It's rubbish! We're an elitist institution. The university is. Period. Full stop. And that's all there is to it. So, I'm sorry for going on so long, but I think it is really important to fill in the blanks. Who is extrinsicized in my life? The handicapped. The handicapped, the different racial or ethnic groups. My God. And we're immersed in it. Go to beautiful Aruba. You know, there's a big ad for the island of Aruba in the Caribbean. And sure enough, you'll see this smiling black guy with a white shirt, a little black bow tie, and a colored sash, serving drinks to these plutocrats who can afford to go to Aruba, you know? There's something nasty about television. When did you really see a poor person on TV? Authentically poor. When did you see an ad on TV where people are not coming out of this upper middle class house, smiling cheerily and jumping into their, I was about to say Mercedes-Benz, but Ian drives an 82-year-old Mercedes-Benz, so we can exclude him. Their Mercedes, their BMW, their Lexus. Folks, what I'm getting at is recently we have a very long way to travel. We have a very long and painful way to travel. Because the breakdown of those unacknowledged prejudices will be painful, I promise you. But if that's not what Advent means, it doesn't mean nice little cute calendars I can hang in my kitchen and every day I open a new window for an Advent treat for the kiddies. Christmas is a great example. We've infantilized Christmas, for God's sake. Think about it. Okay, if you think that I'm angry at you, I'm not angry at you, I'm angry at myself. I'm angry at myself. And guilt-ridden, yes. Martin Buber has a great essay, True and Neurotic Guilt. I recommend it to you. There is such a thing as genuine guilt as opposed to neurotic guilt, which there's plenty of. I'm not as rich as they. I'm not as pretty as they. I don't have the nice wardrobe they have. That's neurotic guilt, folks. So let us keep each other in mind, Paul particularly. A very good friend of mine on the King's faculty with a very serious case of cancer. And all the suffering people, my God in heaven, all the suffering people in the world who outnumber us nice, respectable types, believe me,